Well, I have a bone to pick with Richard. I was going to let everybody think that all that wind was the Holy Spirit backing up what I was saying. And he spilled the beans that it was the wind blowing across his microphone. So always somebody's got to mess up your evil plan, right? You may notice in your bulletin that the title of this lesson is The Pit and the Pedestal. And I would encourage you to spend some time thinking about some of the things that we are going to talk about here. Because I think it's important for us to think about what kind of people God uses to do his work. You know, that's one of the striking differences between Christianity and the other world religions that are around us. Buddha, for example, was the son of a rich family. He was sheltered. He was on a pedestal. As a matter of fact, his family did not even allow him to see somebody who was old. And the first time he saw somebody who was old and realized that he was going to get old, he started his own life as a monastic, as one who lived a very rigid and a very philosophical kind of life. He lived in a pedestal. Muhammad married a rich widow. And a matter of fact, her money is what funded his military exploits. And he lived a very opulent lifestyle. This is true basically of all religious systems on the earth except Christianity. What is different about God as revealed in his world? You know, God's workers have never been people like Buddha. Nobody lived a highly protected, austere life. Very few of us, if any of us, have married into money. That's one thing Cindy was never accused of. But when you look at the leaders of God's people, you see a pattern, a very different pattern that shows the striking difference between what was present in the Old Testament, what was true in Christianity, and what you see in the other world religions. Let's take a couple of examples. Moses. What were Moses' credentials? Remember in Exodus, the third chapter, in verse 10, God said right out the top, "Come now, and I will send you to the Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." You ever thought about why God picked Moses? Moses says, correctly, what would be very likely to happen. Verse 11 of Exodus 3, Moses says, "Who am I that I should go to the Pharaoh?" Verse 13, talking to God, he says, "I don't even know what your name is. So how am I going to tell Israel to pack up and leave?" And then reading on in Exodus, the fourth chapter, verse 1, Moses says, "Well, I think it's pretty obvious. You think I'm going to go to the Israelites and tell them to pack up and leave? They're not going to believe me." I mean, think about that. Think about what Moses would have had in his mind. I know what I would have had. I mean, I can't get my kids to do the right thing sometimes. How am I going to get the whole nation of Israel to just get up and go? And then he carries it on. And in verse 10, he says, I'm not eloquent, I'm slow of speech. Is any of this sounding familiar to you? Have you thought about your job as a Christian and perhaps had some of those same thoughts? Nobody's going to listen to me. I can't get my wife to listen to me. I can't get my husband to listen to me. How am I going to go talk to somebody else? And I don't speak well. I'm not persuasive. If you look logically at why Moses should not have been Israel's leader, there's a bunch of reasons. Number one, he didn't want the job. He didn't want the job. Number two, he was not schooled in Hebrew. He didn't know God's laws. We don't know how much his mother, his biological mother, had taught him. But he certainly was not schooled in it, not educated in it. He had no reputation among the Israelites. You remember when he killed the Egyptian soldier that was abusing the Israelite? The Israelites didn't say thank you. What happened was that he got into another scrape, and the Israelites said, Are you gonna kill me like you did that Egyptian? And Moses was part of the status quo. I don't know whether you saw any of the movies of the Ten Commandments, but they were pretty accurate as far as what Moses would have looked like. He didn't look like an Israelite. He looked like an Egyptian. He was part of the status quo. And when you come on down to the church, who led the church in the first century? Well, you can go down the list. Peter, John. But do you remember what people in the culture of that day said about Peter and John? This is in Acts 4 and verse 13. Now when they saw the boldness of Peter and John and perceived that they were unlearned and ignorant men. They were fishermen. You ever been around a commercial fisherman? I don't imagine it was just different then than it is now. You say, well, I haven't had any education. How much education do you think Peter and John had had? Well, I don't know the Bible. Well, none of us know it as much as we should. But that wasn't something that they used as a justification for not doing what God called them to do. When you look at Moses, when you look at Paul, when you look at Peter, when you look at John, when you look at the people of that day, out of all of those, only Paul was a well-educated man. God has always used those of us that are less educated, less knowledgeable, don't speak well. Let's take another example. You remember Gideon? In Judges 6, starting with verse 11, the history of that is that Israel had left God. And when they left God and turned everything over to the materialism of their day, their enemies came and overran them. You have to worry about our nation today with those same situations. But when this nation of the Midianites overtake them, they impoverished them. They took all their goods. They made them slaves. Verse 6 of Judges 6. And finally, God decides to bail out Israel. And who does he bail out Israel with? A high-powered military leader? A great soldier? An outstanding politician? God says in verse 12 of Judges 6, I pick you. In verse 14, and so what happens? Gideon say, okay, here we go. Gideon, just like Moses. The first thing he says is, well, my family's a poor family. We don't have any money. How about you? You got a lot of money? He says, well, I'm the least in my family. Verse 15. Well, where do you stand in your family? Are you the leader? Finally, in verse 27, Gideon just says, I'm scared. You ever been scared? Afraid of sharing, perhaps? And Gideon is so scared that he starts giving God a whole bunch of tests. Remember the story about the fleece? He says to God, okay, you got a lot of dew out here, but I want you to make this fleece so it doesn't have any dew on it. That violates every common sense principle of how dew forms. So Gideon requires constant reassurance. What's your family like? I think most of you here have family members that have pretty well rejected what you stand for religiously. I certainly do. And probably none of us are standouts in our family. When you're dealing with family, are you scared? Are you fearful? I can't tell you how many times I've literally sweated drops of what looked like blood trying to talk to my father, who was an atheist. I was afraid. Isn't it interesting how what we see God using these people for are the same kinds of problems that you and I have today? How about Joseph? Genesis 37, starting with verse 18, Joseph is thrown in a pit by his brothers. That's verse 22. I said to you this lesson is titled The Pit and the Pedestal. Joseph may have started out thinking he was going to be in the pedestal, but that didn't last very long, did it? He's thrown in a pit. He's sold into slavery, verse 27. He's eventually bought by a man named Potiphar. And then he's betrayed by Potiphar's wife in Genesis 39, verses 7 through 20. He interprets a butler's dream and is promised by the butler that he'll vouch for Joseph, Genesis 40 and verse 14. But then the butler forgets about him. Verse 23. Have people let you down? Have members of the church let you down? How about Mary, the mother of Jesus? You talk about an unlikely person. First of all, she's a woman. You know, it's interesting that Buddha and Muhammad and Zoroaster and Baha'u'llah, they all come in with a lot of flair and with a lot of outstanding credentials. But Mary's a woman in a culture that denigrated women at every turn. Not only that, but she's a teenager. She's too young to know what she should do. Not only that, she came from the wrong side of the tracks. Nazareth was a despised town. And to top it all off, she's pregnant out of wedlock. And so her husband-to-be is in the process of divorcing her. You messed up your life, made some bad choices, functioned in ignorance. Everywhere we look in Scripture, what we see is God choosing the pit, not the pedestal. Not people that were rich. Not the academics. The Apostle Paul stated this lesson very, very well. After mentioning his thorn in the flesh in 2 Corinthians 12, Paul says, Most gladly, therefore, I will glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, I am strong. You know, it's interesting to read Paul's discussion of what he had experienced and what he had been like in his ministry, the things that had taken place to him, 2 Corinthians, the 11th chapter, starting with verse 21. It's 2 Corinthians. I just turned to 1 Corinthians. Listen to what he says. This is about the same time as he's been talking about this thorn in the flesh. He says, I speak as concerning reproach, as though we had been weak. Howbeit, wherever anyone is bold, and I speak foolishly, I am bold also. And now listen to what he says about himself. This is Paul talking. What is the basis of his strength? Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? So am I. Okay, in the military we used to say he puts his shoes on one shoe at a time, like the rest of us. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more, in labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequent, in deaths often. Of the Jews, 5 times received I 40 stripes, save one. Thrice I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Thrice I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I have been in the deep, in journeyings often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, in perils by my own countrymen, in perils by heathen, in perils of the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness, painfully, in watchings often, in hunger and thirst and fastings, often in cold and nakedness. Besides these things that are without, that which came upon me daily in the care of all the churches. Who is weak? And I am not weak. Who is offended? I burn not. I must needs glory. I will glory in the things which concern my infirmities. Why does he say all that? What has happened in your life? You just heard what Paul said had happened to him. What's happened in your life? We heard Jim Harris Savage last Sunday talk about his battle with cancer. As we were standing around and talking, he was explaining his discussion with his grandchildren and the fact that he may not live. In his sermon, he made reference to the things that he thought were important based upon the things that had been a part of his life. You know, one of the reasons I respect Jim Harris Savage so much, I know his past. I know when his wife was unfaithful to him and divorced him, and then she got into trouble, that he went and helped her out, provided for her, even though she had been miserable with him. I remember him taking care of his brother who was a product of an illegitimate relationship and who had severe mental problems. I remember the time that he spent working, even right up to the time he went to Indianapolis to be treated for cancer, helping to clear that building and clean it. I could sit here for hours telling you the stuff I know about Jim. But an awful lot of you here know that, don't you? Because you've seen what he did and how he functioned and what he what's about. So what has happened in your life? We didn't plan this, but I think it's wonderful that Willard's kind act accomplished something that none of us probably could have done. If you saw a woman along the edge of the highway with a vehicle problem, you're by yourself, you know what can happen if you pick up a woman and take her into town. See, Willard has a talent. He has a big heart. And that's not the first time that Willard's done stuff like that. I have tried to share with you things that have been a part of my life. Why? Because I have some big ego trip about what I have done and been a part of? No, it's not those things that have given me whatever strength I have. Being the only white kid in a black school in a black community has given me a unique insight on what's going on right now in the racial parts of this country and in the church. Being disowned by my family have given me a unique perspective on what some of you have gone through. Being poor has given me an opportunity to know what poverty is about. My daughter still remembers how mad she was at me for plowing up the front yard to grow vegetables because we didn't have any food. Kathy's still upset about that one. I remember cashing in my Buffalo nickel collection to buy milk. I remember being near death in the military, having a kid pull a gun on me in my classroom, marrying a woman with chronic medical problems. When Cindy and I got married, one of the things that it took me a little while to adjust to was I didn't give her a shot every morning because my first wife was diabetic and I was part of my ritual. I sort of thought it went with the territory. Having a child born with massive congenital problems has bonded me with people like Joanne Rice and given me an opportunity to serve in other ways. Having your life's companion die have given me the capacity to relate to some of you that have lost your wife or your husband. Sandy Hafner and I spent a great deal of time on the phone as she battled bladder cancer. We lost her just 10 days ago. And Patty was telling me that she has donated a sizable amount of money to the church here. You know what her job was? She was a cafeteria worker. She lost her husband several years ago. So I had a unique relationship with her because we shared a common bond. You see, the way this church is going to grow, the way it has grown, the way it continues to make changes in the community is for those of us who are from the pit are willing to share our struggles, our history. So once again, let me suggest to you sometime in the next week, sit down and write what has happened in your life and how those experiences can be used to reach out and to change the world in which we live and to bear fruit for the Lord. Paul says, "Most gladly, therefore, will I glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong." And you see, all of these examples we've looked at this morning, Moses, Gideon, Mary, Joseph, all of them had people who supported them and encouraged them and allowed them to use their experiences to change the world around them. You know, the days of us holding a gospel meeting, putting up a big tent or having some kind of a evangelistic sermon type meeting, pretty well over. People don't respond in that way. Not in our culture today. They didn't in the early days of the church either. But what did change the world was what happened in Acts, the first chapter, when the church met together. And the Bible says that they addressed the needs of everybody around them. Your talents, your abilities come from your experience. And one of the things we can do periodically is to support one another, helping us to see what our talents are and giving us the tools and the encouragement and the strength to make our lives count. Willard set us a great example. Jim Harris Savage gave us a marvelous example. We've seen how Bill Gibson is dealing with his struggles, with pain, and with his heart situation. We've seen how Richard and Tina have dealt with Alzheimer's in Melba, and how they've cared for her. I mean, I could spend another hour here just going through this audience and identifying things that I have seen some of you do that have been marvelous testimonies to the power of Christ. You are an evangelist. You are a missionary. And using your experiences is something every one of us can do. Like Moses, we're chosen, even though we're in the pit. Like Gideon, like Joseph. But we meet like this to encourage one another. One way we encourage one another is to sing together, to pray together, to encourage one another, so that we may go from our meetings here out there and make a change in the world around us because of what has been a part of our history. If you have a need this morning that you would like to share with us, if there's ways we can be of help to you, we encourage you to come and express that need so that we can encourage you and strengthen you, and we can reach out to the community around us. If you're subject to the invitation of Jesus, we encourage you to come as together we stand and sing. Won't you please come?